Okay, thank you very much. And as usual, many thanks for the organizer for the opportunity to be here. Also happy to be here in the sense that it's 9 o'clock and I didn't miss my talk. So the topic will be somewhat out of the line of the rest of this conference, I would guess. But I'm trying to explain why. Nevertheless, maybe this has some interesting. This system has some interesting properties, which hopefully could set insight also to some classical systems. But anyway, so the main part of the talk will be about a quantum system, namely a system of bosons. And this is a work in collaboration with Jogi Panjabadai and Antti Kupiainen at the University of Helsinki. So the problem we wanted to address or look into more detail is the following. So recently there have been new mathematical results on certain type of Bose condensation. So in physics, often one uses for the condensate an effective description called the Gross-Pitayski equation. And there have been two types of derivation of this equation. First of all, a stationary one by Leib, Seidinger, and Ingvarsson. So the idea here is that you prepare your system in such a state which is essentially very close to a ground state, a total ground state of the system, and then you take a mean field limit. And doing this leads to a 100% condensation. You will have a condensate wave function, and this condensate wave function, if you start the system from spatially inhomogeneous setup, then there's a second result by Edelstein and Yao, which shows that even the time evolution of this wave function is determined by the time-dependent Gross-Pitayski equation. But these results really are working very close to the ground state. So the question is, what happens if you have a finite temperature? In particular, what happens if you have a system which is a combination of a condensate and normal fluid? But before going to that, let me talk about a simpler system. So that's a completely classical system. So it's a system, well, not classical, it's a wave equation. In fact, the psi t here is just a complex field on a lattice. D is a dimension. There's a linear path to evolution and a nonlinear interaction. So that's a discretized version of the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. This coupling here, lambda, it's assumed to be positive. So that's the so-called dispersive case. And the or defocusing. And then there's this linear path which is determined by alpha. And we have a certain result, rigorous result, related to time correlations at equilibrium for such system. And in that case, it already became clear that if you want to analyze this system, it actually matters. There's the structure of this alpha actually can play a role. So I just want to say that there's a large class of alpha for which this coming results would hold, but not necessarily for all of them. So in particular, for instance, in our case, this is a work with Herbert Spohn, in fact, an earlier work with Herbert Spohn. We had to assume a dimension greater than or equal to 4, and lots of assumptions which were satisfied by the nearest neighbor interaction. But let's describe in detail what we can think will happen in the system under a certain type of initial state. So first of all, we had assumption on the linear evolution, but more importantly, we assume a lot about the initial state. So initial state it assumed to be random, and one of the main important things achieved by randomness is that we can take a translation invariant. So this random distribution of the correlations is the same independent of the lattice point, and that is actually one of the important properties because it immediately implies certain mathematical relations like this one. So if I look at the two-point function, it only depends on the difference. But this holds for all higher order correlations as well. So as I said, this only follows from translation invariance. And now the kinetic conjecture is that if you start your system from such a state, you look at this function W tilde of T, you rescale time using the kinetic scaling. So lambda is really now the coupling on the previous slide. So lambda is the positive but small coupling of the nonlinearity. You fix tau, you take this limit. The claim is, let me think. So this F here is a Fourier transform. That's a function on lattice, so after Fourier transform we get the function on the torus. And this function should converge under this rescaling of tau to another function. But moreover, not only this limit should exist, it should satisfy this particular nonlinear Boltzmann equation. And this structure is actually determined by the microscopic dynamics. So in particular here, it's not maybe completely obvious, we see the alpha. The alpha, the Fourier transform of alpha will appear in this Boltzmann equation, the kernel of the Boltzmann equation. Oh, and one more thing I wanted to mention. So that's of course obvious, but I mean, well, what does this result really mean? I mean, that's something which is good to keep in mind. It's not a statement about the infinite time evolution of the system at all. I mean, this is a statement about this is a statement of the following type. So if I can find a solution to this equation, I can solve it, and if it happens that the solution is unique, then I know that this using this solution, I get a good approximation for my original time correlates or the original covariance matrices or covariance functions up to time scales or the lambda to minus 2. So something else might happen if I wait longer, but I mean, certainly, I mean, if this is true, I mean, we only make statements about this up to this time scale. And one important ingredient on this derivation, in particular in the rigorous one, what I mentioned, briefly mentioned before, is the following type of expansion. So this one here is an identity. This only follows from the translation invariance, in fact. So if you take your initial data, which we assume to be translation invariant distribution, and you look at the Fourier transform of your initial field, this sigma here it denotes because this is complex field, so you have to look at the field and its complex conjugate separately, but then never mind the sigma at the moment. So important part is in the Fourier transform. Now, because of translation invariance, you can use the cumulant expansion and write this expectation of the Fourier transform as sums over partitions of your index set. And this is very similar to the cluster expansion. So you have this set of indices given by I, and they are clustered in all possible ways, so that for each cluster, you gain one delta function. And then there is something which is called the truncated correlation function. It's really a cumulant. So that should be, that's a bad notation. But I mean, what this really means is the end for the cumulant. So because of translation invariance, we get this delta function here. So here we fix one of the points, and now we're looking at the Fourier transform in the differences, if you wish. Okay, so that's an identity. But the reason why it's a useful identity comes from the following observation. If you have a system which is at equilibrium, in particular this system at equilibrium, Abdeserov, Prokocki, and Skopola, they have proven that in that case something which is called L1 clustering holds. So what this L1 clustering essentially means that these correlations, what I had previously, if you fix one point which is related to removal of the translation invariance, they actually decay so fast in the differences that this is summable over the whole. That is, and this should actually be the CD in my notation here, but never mind that. So you should think of these sums over this whole that is in time. And for the equilibrium distribution, it's almost Gaussian, because, okay, I didn't mention this, but it's a Hamiltonian system, and in fact, I mean, that's the reason why you can say a lot about it. So if you look at the equilibrium state, it's a natural grand canonical type of Gibbs state. And for such states, what you have not only is it summable, it's uniform in the volume, and it's proportional to lambda. But that's only for equilibrium. So typically, we don't need to assume proportional to lambda here. But in addition, the second point, correlations are summable. So that's what I would call L1 clustering. If you look at these truncated correlation functions, they are L1 summable in differences. And these properties imply, in particular, that these previous functions, Cn, which were functions of this wave vectors k, they are uniformly bounded. And therefore, if I now go back to my expansion here, I know that this function here, which is super singular, it nevertheless can be decomposed into parts where I have an explicit singularity and an L infinite function. And that this is a consequence of translation invariance and L1 clustering. So as I mentioned, I mean, using these properties, we could prove a certain rigorous statement about kinetic scale limits of time correlations. But let me now come to the bosons. The reason actually why I'm talking about bosons, I don't want to talk about the previous system, is that in fact there is a lot of work which has been done relating to this bosonic system, and we to really motivate why we think the following result is also microsquiff validity is based on simulations and other results relating to this system. So let's look at the bosons for a moment. So it looks completely different. So, well, okay, we look still on lattice, and the dimension is now 3. We have a weak on-site pair interaction between these quantum particles. This lattice is convenient because then it directly relates to the previous equation. So we have a time evolution which doesn't change the particle number. It really lives on the Fock space, but it conserves particle number. And for each n particle sector, we have this type of Hamiltonian. There's a free part, where this you can think of as a discrete Laplacian, and that's close to the previous alpha. And then there's a pair interaction between particles on the same site. And now we make an assumption about the initial state, that it's also translation invariant. So it's given by, let's say, a density matrix which commutes to the translations of lattice translations. And it's also L1 clustering. So for this quantum system, one can look at the cumulants in the same sense as before. And we assume that they are also summably decay. They decay summably in the differences. And the reason why I was mentioning the previous equation is that it's actually a commutative version of this one. So if IAX is now the annihilation operator related to the site X on the lattice, this is the usual Heisenberg picture about annihilation operator. So this is still an operator in the Fock space. Then you can check that from the previous time evolution, Hamiltonian time evolution given by the previous pair interaction, this annihilation operator satisfies this equation. So that's an operator equation now. It has exactly the same structure as the one before, but the only difference is now in the interaction term here, this thing is not commutative anymore. So the AXT is still an operator, but otherwise the structure is very similar. So if I would just say, replace A by the previous psi, and then replace the alpha by this discrete Laplacian, I would get the previous nonlinear Schrödinger equation. And what is the closest observable to the previous two-point function is the so-called one-particle density matrix. So it's just defined by you take the initial state, you look at these operators, the product of them, and you take the trace over the initial state. So that's a well-defined function, and because of translation invariance, also in this case, it depends only on the lattice differences. And the corresponding kinetic context in this case is almost the same as before. The only difference comes from the structure of the initial state. So I don't really have time to go into how these kinetic contexts are derived. But one important ingredient is that the main part of the collision curl actually comes from oscillating integrals. And because the linear structures are identical, the non-commutativity doesn't actually play any role whatsoever. For these oscillating integrals, they are identical between these two models. What is different is when you look at this moments to cumulant formula. And then in that formula, when you look at the expectations for the initial state, one has to remember that they don't commute anymore. But this non-commutativity, in fact, I mean, the only thing which is important here is that the order of these fields. So I define a function WK. This follows from translation invariance, the existence of that. If I swap the order, I get the one plus the same function here. That follows from the bosonic canonical commutation relation. So that's the only place where I see the fact that these are bosons. But the context is otherwise the same. So if I look at this function here, now it's already in Fourier space. I make the kinetic scaling of time. Because of translation invariance, I don't have the scale space. That's maybe something which you already have been wondering. But nevertheless, time scaling is here enough. I take this limit. The claim is that this function exists, and it satisfies the Boltzmann equation. And this Boltzmann equation is almost the same as before, except that now there are extra terms. So there's an extra term, quadratic term, appearing, coming from the fact that this initial A and A star didn't commute. But otherwise, in fact, I mean, it's not obvious in this way of writing. So here, H tilde is 1 plus A. So that's, if you remember, think about it, it's really coming from this swapping of the order. The collision part of the kernel looks a bit different, but in fact, if you expand these tildes here, you get the third order term, which is identical to the discrete nonlinear Schrödinger equation, plus the second order term, which is coming when you have ones both here. This level 4 looks like this. And that is very close to the rarefied Gauss-Boltzmann equation kernel. But that's the only difference. And here now, I'm going to talk about this equation. I just wanted to motivate why it's not just coming out of a thin air, and also to give an idea what type of assumptions actually go into this equation. So the one thing which I already made here, which is very difficult to control rigorously, is that I already took the replaced the lattice by the corresponding continuum setup. So this helps a lot for the Boltzmann equation, because now this Fourier transform of alpha becomes this usual kinetic energy, which is a simple function. So this equation is certainly simple to analyze. It goes over now instead of torus over R to the 3, but otherwise it's the same equation as before. And just to recall what are the assumptions under which we think that this should be a valid approximation of the original system, kinetic timescales only, translation invariant initial state, and L1 clustering. And the one which I want to stress in this talk is L1 clustering, in fact. And you will see soon why. But before going any further, let's make one more extra assumption about the initial state. So this equation still has 4 variables, so let's remove 2 of them. Let's assume that this initial state is also isotropic in velocity. So it only depends on the magnitude of the velocity, meaning that it only depends on the kinetic energy. So now this x is no longer a point on the lattice. Now it denotes the kinetic energy of the corresponding particle. And after a bit of algebra and analysis, you actually can transform the previous equation to this one. It starts looking more simple. No delta functions anymore. 2 integrals left over a certain region, which is not too difficult to compute. There is a kernel part which looks like a square root of the x minimum of the kinetic energies over 1 over square root of the input kinetic energy, if you wish. And then the collision kernel has the same structure as on the previous slide. And now the question is, how do these solutions to this equation look like? So for instance, we know that this bosonic system should show Bose condensation. So is there any, how does this relate to this particular setup? And here is numerical solution to that equation. So what this is, what these plots are, this is from a paper by Semikos and Karchev. The initial data is shown here. It's this dashed line here. And these corresponding solid lines, they are time evolved. They are sort of snapshots of the solution for different times, and the time proceeds when you go here. And in fact, this time here is not going to infinite. It's going to some finite T0 value. So this numerical simulation shows that the previous equation has solutions which blow up in finite time at origin. Okay, can we understand this somehow physically? So the reason why this was done this way was that this particular initial data, although it's far, far from obvious, is actually supercritical. So this density here in this system is supercritical, and in fact one would expect to see Bose condensation. So one could think that this is a sign of Bose condensation in some sense. But for the Boltzmann equation, this is of course a disaster, because it's a nonlinear equation. If we have singularities, we definitely need to take very great care what we do with these singularities. But let's look at the previous Boltzmann equation in a little bit more detail. So this is something which I guess some people are very familiar with, but let's recall it anyway. So just if you assume that your solution is sufficiently nice and regular and et cetera, you can find a Lyapunov function for this system. So that's the H theorem in this setup. So the entropy function of a Lyapunov function looks like this. You differentiate it, you find that this is the corresponding entropy production term. And this term here is always positive, so this is increasing. And the steady states. That was 1 plus h. 1 plus h. So that's just a shorthand notation. In particular, for steady states, it should be 0. So we can all compute all candidates for regular steady state just by looking at zeros of this entropy production. So this was this I think is fairly standard. It can be found. The details can be found in papers by Herbert and also other people, of course. But anyway, so if you just solve this zeros of this entropy production, you find that there's two parameter family of steady states, and they all look like that. And these are the standard Bose-Einstein distributions, in fact. So the parameters have been chosen so that they coincide with the standard parameters. Beta is 1 over temperature, and mu is a chemical potential. But this analysis shows that for regular states, there should be no resolutions. Now the question comes, if you assume that your state is regular, you also find that what happened to that? There are two conservation laws in the original system, and they are translated when we translate into this language, these two functionals. There's something which relates to the particle number or particle density, and the second one which relates to the energy density. So they differ only by this factor of phi here, and they are controlled by the microscopic evolution, and they are controlled formally for smooth solutions. But that's a bit of a puzzle. I can start this system from such a state that I don't have any steady states of the previous form. So that's again the standard argument for Bose condensation. So either they are unique beta and mu such that they coincide with these two numbers, given initial numbers, or there is a unique beta such that there is some leftover density. The leftover is with this, so that this beta is fixed by the energy. This energy fixes a maximal density, so you can vary mu now and it has a finite maximum. And if your initial density is more than that, you have to think that something happens to this extra density. And one possible context is that it just stops moving. So here one physical context would be that the steady state in this case would no longer be regular. It would be corresponding to a critical steady state. And then this delta x is really a delta at zero velocity. So these are particles which don't move. This extra condensate is a certain density of particles which don't move at all anymore. But of course, that starts to look now a bit fishy because now we have nonlinear equations and distributions. So this was a mathematical puzzle. So let's see what type of solutions can we have. So first of all, I mean, it's not at all obvious that this Boltzmann equation has anything to say about the condensation. It just might break down at the new form of the condensation. So that's certainly one possibility. But let's see if it might contain some information. So let's look at this equation still, and let's suppose that the initial data is no longer regular. Let's suppose, for instance, it has a singularity at origin. For instance, this previous critical Bose-Einstein distributions, they have a 1 over x singularity at origin. So they are already singular. So for instance, if you started from a little bit stronger singularity, 7 over 6, then there is a work by Escobar, de Michelin, and Velasquez. They show that there exists a solution, at least for some finite time, which preserves this singularity, but it has a little bit unpleasant feature that it doesn't present total mass. So that's one of those cases when this formal derivation of differentiation inside integral signs gives you bad results. Because from this differentiation, you would have thought that the total mass must be preserved. But here it doesn't. And this is certainly a solution, point-wise solution to this equation for all x greater than zero, but it does not preserve the total mass. Here's another way of extending this equation. You think that this F is actually a probability measure. Well, it doesn't need to probability, so it's a positive measure. So the positivity is related to the positive density of particles at any k value. And then you try to look at this in a weak form, this equation, and see if it has solutions. And there's a series of work by Shugu and Lu. And he shows that there's a family of positive measures which solves this weakly, this equation, and which conserves both energy and mass. So certainly his solutions cannot be the same ones as here. And the trouble with these things, of course, that it's very, very difficult to prove uniqueness, and he can't do it either. And the argument's a bit non-constructive. So numerical simulations, this is not a very feasible strategy. But anyway, so then we have a puzzle here. So we have two types of solutions which don't coincide. So this certainly looks a little bit unphysical. So the only way you could sort of make connection to the physics would be that what happens to this extra mass is preserved by the microscopic dynamics, so it must go somewhere. And in this case, you could think that it goes to the condensate, but then the condensate has no longer any back reaction on the normal point. Because that's what you assume if you do it like this. There was another way of explaining this, is which is just by making an ansatz. So this ansatz is essentially just saying that after condensation, this looks forms of two parts. There's a regular part, which is regular in the sense it's not the measure, and then there's a measure part which looks like the what you would assume to be true for the condensate. So the particles say certain number, time dependent number of density particles like that which don't move. You plug this ansatz into the equation, and you find this coupled set of equations. And Herbert Spohn did some analysis of this. This was Semikos and Karchev also already before him, but I mean, he also clarified this a little bit. So in this equation, it's actually important to very carefully keep track of the singularities on the collision kernel. For instance, here's an example again that if you do things carefully, you see a difference. So if you have a 1 over x singularity, and you look at this evolution of this n of t in the previous equation, it has a term which is proportional to the strength of the singularity. So if I don't have this singularity, I have anything less than that, this term is simply absent. If I have a stronger singularity, something else happens. Even this term, which should be zero before, develops a negative sign. And this is this type of sign, in fact, is presumably, or this effect is presumably the one which is responsible for the loss of mass in the solution of Escobar et al. Okay, so that maybe is not a positive thing, but a negative thing. So you really have to be careful. So that usually spells trouble. But let's see what might be one possible scenario. So suppose you start the system like in the simulation which we saw before. It's supercritical but regular initial data. What should happen then? Presumably this numerical simulation for the smooth function still captures the right result. So after some time, it becomes singular at origin. As soon as it's singular, something has to be done more carefully. But after this blow up, it might be, or it is sort of would be reasonable maybe that the solution is of the form of the ansatz before. And in particular, if it's anywhere close to the stationary state, it should have 1 over x singularity. So the strength of the singularity should change somehow in this step. And there should be a seed for the condensate. And after that, it should you might think that the system, this coupled system, which is a regular part plus the density of the condensate, follows this previous coupled equation. Okay, so what was now our goal was to study this last point and to really prove that this coupled set of equations has solutions if you start the system not too far from equilibrium. In particular, I mean, one of the assumptions which we make is that the initial data has this 1 over x singularity. But then the main point is to show that if you start it from a small perturbation of equilibrium in that sense, you go back to the right physical equilibrium. But one more thing. So in fact, this derivative for n is a little bit unpleasant. It can blow up. So we make one more change into the equation. So we replace this n derivative by explicit mass conservation law. So we know that our solution conserves mass just because we enforce it from the very beginning. And this way we can get rid of the second equation, and we can obtain this nonlinear equation for the regular part alone. So this term is the original Boltzmann-Nordheim equation. That term was on the previous slide as NT, and we just replaced the mass conservation law here. And this term you compute using the ansatz. It's a little bit more singular term than we see before, but it's also of the Boltzmann type. And as I said, we are looking at small perturbations and try to show that they converge to equilibrium. And the way one studies this problem is by linearization. Unfortunately for us, well, I guess one should not be surprised. It's a little bit delicate system, so this problem is actually, although the scheme is standard, the solution turned out to be rather unpleasant. It's unpleasant because, okay, so this is one point maybe which I should mention. So you make the usual linearization, and you try to show that the linearized part dominates over the, or at least keeps this nonlinear part sufficiently bounded. And for that, you really need to know a lot about the linearized part. So explicit, if you just write it, it has to set this type of form. It really looks like a master equation. The only trouble is that this is not in L1, and actually it's not even positive. It has some small negative part as well. But the main difficulty really comes from the fact that it has two types of singularities. There is the diagonal singularity which makes it not in L1, and in addition there is singularity at the origin. The K4 is less singular. So K3 is the linearization of this extra term, and K4 is the linearization of the original equation. So this singularity on the diagonal looks like it's going to spoil everything, but in fact that's really necessary. So typically this nonlinear term is of course equally singular as the linear one. So you need to have some mechanism which cancels the singularities from the nonlinear term. And the mechanism here is provided, so we exponentiate the linear part, and in fact because of the singularities of the kernel, and then this is a statement which involves the science of the kernel as well, it leads to smoothing of the solution. The smoothing is super slow, it's logarithmic in K, in the Fourier variable. So it means that this kernel essentially smooths your solutions like only as a power. And that's the second reason why this is a little bit delicate. Because we also have the other singularities which are equally strong as this one, so you really have to make sure that they don't spoil this. But in the end, I mean, this type of smoothing is exactly what we need to restore the singularity generated by nonlinear time. And the way we do it in practice is that we try to solve this in a certain Banach space. I didn't actually mention what these psi's are, I just remember. So it was here. So this linearization is done in the following way. So you take this critical equilibrium distribution, and then you scale your solution with a scale function. I didn't write the formula, but anyway, the main point is that it's 1 over x singularity. So it's essentially, near origin, it behaves like a critical solution. And this psi is now the remainder. So this is going to be what we want to be small. So one of the things which was proven by Herbert, in fact, that if psi is zero, that creates a solution to the previous coupled equations. So that, and in particular, it creates a stationary solution. So we do know that this is by itself, if psi goes zero, is a stationary solution. That's why there is no zeroth over term here. But anyway, for psi, we have to use these unpleasant norms. So these are sort of Hölder-type norms. And there are two types of norms. The reason is that, as I said, this nonlinearity, even if we start this very nice, so these things are very nice. So they are Hölder smooth everywhere else except on the diagonal. Near zero, they are even much better because of this extra singularity. Nevertheless, even if you put such nice smooth things or continuously things to the nonlinearity, it creates singularities. It cancels, for instance, this part, and it makes logarithmic extra singularity on the diagonal. So we have a second space for what happens after the operation of the time derivative. So the space x is for psi's, for these functions, and the x prime is for the time derivatives. And then these norms, I mean, if we change this norm, we have to change that one, but I mean, some parts of this mapping are determined. So whatever you choose here, you will have some nastiness happening there. And now the point is what I said. I mean, what this makes things worse, so this you can't iterate. What you can iterate is that you really make everything into a Duhamel formula, and the full time integrated Duhamel kernel. So this by itself, without the time integral, would not be good enough. We need the time integral in this case. It's actually a map from x to x. So that's also a little bit of a borderline case. And in addition, so this gives shows us that we are working in a sensible space. So we might have solutions in x because of this. The second thing which we need for the decay to equilibrium is that we need to have a spectral gap, and we need to have it in X. So we need a property like this. So this linear operator also acts like this. So it's like a time derivative. So it takes the solution and makes them a bit worse. But the singularities are positive. So when I look at the semigroup, it actually makes things better. Okay, so some of the technical details, but maybe I go through very quickly. So one of the trouble here is that we are working with subnorms. Subnorms are nice for the nonlinear term, but L2 norms would be nice for the linear part, for the semigroup. But one reason why we can do that is a sort of a Sobolev type of inequality. So we can combine L2 control will have control over this these things along these differences to obtain a control for subnorms. And here is the main estimate which we need to prove. I don't know if there's anything very interesting here. So this is essentially just saying what I said on the previous slide. So there's this logarithmic extra singularity which needs to be cancelled, and it's cancelled by the fact that it becomes slightly smoother at the same speed as this one. And then there's the generation of this extra decay at origin. And the gap in X is proven by a similar bound, and combining it with the gap of the semigroup in L2. And then one more thing, unpleasant thing about this system, which I forgot to mention. So this L2 space I'm talking about, it's a natural L2 space. It has a sort of a non-trivial weight under which this linearized operator is positive as an operator in a Hilbert space. The trouble is that this space is too big to be a solution space for the nonlinear problem. It contains functions which have infinite densities. So that's one of the reasons why it's not at all reasonable that you try to solve this problem in the natural L2 space of the linear evolution. Because for this infinite density, we simply do not... I don't think it's reasonable to expect that the nonlinear equation has solutions. At least not for all times. Okay, so let me skip those. So the way we prove those things is... I can talk about that if asked for later, but let's recall what exactly is the statement then. So this statement is only for supercritical case. So we assume that the initially, so this n bar is really equilibrium extra density. So you start your system from something which has supercritical stationary states, and you suppose that the initial data is so close to the corresponding equilibrium state that the norm in this X norm, the previous X norm, is sufficiently small, then there is a unique solution in the class of this type of solutions, which conserves total energy. It conserves total mass by construction, because we just put the extra mass in NT, and it converts exponentially fast to equilibrium. So this regular part converges to the right critical density, and this NT converges to this particular N bar as T goes to infinity. And these solutions, they have these properties derived by Herbert Spohn, and in particular, if you look, now that I have my FXT and NT, I can construct these measures, these positive measures, and these positive measures, in addition, they also are weak solutions to the original Boltzmann equation without C4, in the sense which was considered by Liu previously. So in some sense, they generate positive measures of valued solutions, weak solutions to the original Boltzmann-Nordheim equation as well. Okay, so that was for a quantum system. So it looks like it's not very relevant, maybe for classical systems, but that was the reason why I went to the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. So let me jump back a little bit. The third order term was identical to the one for the Boltzmann-Nordheim equation. And the corrections, there was an extra term, it was second order. But whenever H explodes, so it diverges, this is the dominant term. So therefore, if you look at the solution to this equation, they actually should behave, as far as you are looking at the solutions which blow up, near this blow up, this should behave exactly like the ones of the other equation. Just because this should be dominating the second order term. The second order term is actually needed for other reasons. So the second order term is dominant when this is small. So that actually is responsible for the fact that you get this exponential decay at plus infinity, which is also a problem. But here on the lattice, the plus infinity doesn't appear. So for this lattice discrete nonlinear Schrödinger equation, one should really see the same condensation phenomena as for the previous one. But that has not been tested. I know no simulations of this model, and they might be tricky because one important thing was that your steady state. So you can do the steady state analysis for this equation. You find that they are of the form 1 over omega, the critical ones. And the steady state 1 over omega, well, it depends on the singularity at origin, but I mean, let's say for P squared type of singularities, this would be infinite in two dimensions, but finite in three. So the condensation should happen in three, but probably not in two. So you would need the simulation of the three-dimensional model, and that looks maybe unfeasible, but anyway, that would be something interesting to check. And what then coming back to the bosons, microscopically, I mean, as I said, I mean, this is a bit fishy. So what can go wrong? We have the derivation of the Boltzmann equation under very reasonable sounding assumptions, so what could go possibly wrong? And the one which goes wrong probably, and most likely, is the L1 clustering. So if I want to make a conjecture, what happens microscopically is that in a finite kinetic time, this L1 clustering, which was true initially, is lost. And you gain this extra long-term correlation. So this correlation function no longer decays. So there's a piece which goes to a constant, and that's the way in which you generate now a completely new Boltzmann equation. But this type of thing is at the moment a little untestable, so we are working on that, but I mean, I don't want to claim any results on this. So formally you can just plug in these answers and get the right equation, but that's maybe not so convincing. So it should really be more consistent argument, which would say that typically you would expect something like this to happen. But anyway, so that's certainly an open problem. So you would even on the same level of formality as for the other case, if one could derive this particular equation starting from initial data of this time. But let me conclude with the references. So this derivation of C4, if you are interested in detail, there is a paper with Herbert Spohn. We do that. This mathematical result relating to the Boltzmann-Northheim equation, we are just writing it up, so there is no reference yet available, to hopefully soon. And this, if you are interested in the rigorous control of the conjecture, I mean, there is this paper which recently appeared, which I also wrote with Herbert Spohn. And these are the two results I mentioned about the mean field limit and total condensation. That was the Escobedo. And this collection, these are the loose papers for the measure valued solution, and that was the numerical paper with the physical answer, and this was Herbert's analysis of the answer. But I guess it's a good time to stop. And thank you.